Good morning. It is time once again for misbehaving ancestors. That's what this class ought to be called. Oh, I forgot. I forgot the Midrash book. All right. Well, I'll tell you about it nonetheless. Okay. This is, in a way, a little bit of a transitional class, because we're moving now to the story of Sodom, which will take us a little bit of time. But first, we have to do the second half today of the announcement of the birth of Yitzchak, and this is the part that focuses on Sarah. Up to now, we have seen God send, remember last time, three men slash angels, and the text is deliberately ambiguous about whether they're men or they're angels. And so is Abraham's reaction ambiguous. Abraham treats them as men, but they make a prediction that could only be made by people who have some kind of supernatural access, that will return next year and you will have a son. And Abraham is overwhelmed by this. He falls on his face, which he does more than once in this chapter. And when they first come, of course, the first thing that he says that he does is to express hospitality by preparing food for them, having Sarah prepare food for them. And all of that was from last time. Now we're going to begin at chapter 18, verse 9. The three men are still in his home. Avraham, remember, just recovered from his Brit Milah, from his circumcision. Let's see. I don't know how to pause. I'm going to see if I can pause this for 1 second. So we're at verse 9. And the angel said to him, "Where is your wife Sarah?" Now, obviously, this is one of those cases, just as when God says to Adam, "Where are you?" in the beginning of the book of Bereshit, of Genesis, that is, to the traditional commentators, this is a courtesy. God is saying, "Where is your wife Sarah?" And the Midrash has a very nice comment on this. If you look at the verse 9 in the Hebrew, it says, "Vayomru," and they said, "Elav." Do you see that word, Elav? What's strange about it? What's that? No, it's not strange about the actual word. Right, it has three dots above it. Right? It has three diamond-shaped dots above it. And many of these marks appear in the text, not some. And some we know why they're there and some we don't. The Midrash says it's over Aleph, Yud, and Vav for Ayo. That is, the angel said to Sarah first, "Where is Abraham?" And then said to Abraham, "Where is Sarah?" to make it reciprocal. So that they weren't just asking Abraham where Sarah is, but Ayo is, "Where is he?" So they say that the reason the dots are there is to indicate that actually the angels asked both about the other. For what it's worth, it is at least an attempt of the rabbis to make this an equal inquiry. And he replied, "There in the tent, Hinei ba'ohel." Okay? Sarah is in the tent. And if you don't think, by the way, that there is a Midrashic comment that says this indicates that the appropriate place, yes, if you think that that doesn't exist, then I will not disillusion you. But remember, when you say there's a Midrashic comment, sometimes Midrashim are reflective of the attitude of the tradition in general, and sometimes Midrashim are reflective of the attitude of the individual rabbi who said it. Not every rabbi would subscribe to every Midrash. This is not the same as an established halakha, an established Jewish law, right? You won't find a classical rabbi who will say, you don't really, have to keep the Shabbat. But you will find lots of disagreement about Midrashic traditions. So I'm sure, in fact, most rabbis thought otherwise. Or not. Okay. Hine ba ohel. There she is in the tent. Vayomer. And he said, then one said, I will return to you next year, and your wife Sarah shall have a son. Now remember, this is the angel talking to Abraham, but presumably the angel is aware of the fact that Sarah overhears. Okay? The question then arises, so why didn't he just go to the tent and tell Sarah? And the answer is, Abraham is the head of the family. That's one. What else?
Was there a
name? The idea of going into a tent as a man and speaking privately to a woman was very much at odds with the nature of the society. You don't do that to a, especially not to a married woman. Well, actually, maybe even especially not to a single woman, either one. So he could stand outside the tent and say something that Sarah would overhear, but that he would actually go into the tent and speak to her privately. In fact, there is even, this was a very interesting question. You know, there is in the Jewish tradition a concept of called yichud. People hear of it usually after a wedding. A bride and a groom go into a room alone for yichud. But yichud is also a concept that applies outside of marriage. That is, a man and a woman are not supposed to be married, are not supposed to be alone together in a space for the same reason that, right, she wouldn't go into the tent. And I remember once I was working with a publicist on my first book who was Hasidic. And we were supposed to drive to an event, and she was supposed to come with me, and she had to first ask her rabbi if that was yichud, or if it was appropriate, if it was allowed. He actually allowed it, but other rabbis, I suspect, wouldn't. And that is a real, I mean, that concept does exist in the Jewish tradition. So the rabbis interpret this as a violation of yichud, if he would go into the tent. So instead, he tells Avraham in a way that Sarah overhears. Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent, which was behind him. Okay? Now, well, let's read the next couple sentences as a block, and then we'll go back over them. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Sarah had stopped having the periods of women. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now that I am withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old? Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah say, shall I in truth bear a child old as I am? Now, what do you notice about this?
Yeah. The fact that Sarah laughed was sort of, would have been an embarrassment to her husband. And so when they repeat it, they don't want to hurt his feelings.
Right.
And so they
yes. And in fact, you are as delicate as the Torah because you said when they repeated. But that's not what the Torah says.
Oh.
Who lied here? God. God. Right? God, it's exactly what it is. It is a white lie. And that's exactly how the rabbis interpret it. They say for shalom bayit, which is peace of the house, even God told a white lie. Because it's not just that God omits, but God actually misquotes what Sarah says. Right? She says, now that I'm withered, am I to have enjoyment? And he says, shall I in truth bear a child old as I am? The word old did not apply to her. It applied to Avraham. So there's a clear, I mean, you can imagine the Midrash rushes in with this and says that, in fact, in order to establish harmony, a white lie is permitted. And that's exactly what God does here. Now, also, remember that the Bible is very cryptic. It uses very few words. So it expends three sentences on this, and they're all worth taking a look at. Now, Avraham and Sarah were old. That's one. Okay? We already know this, by the way. Right? We are aware of that. We've been following them through their lives since chapter 12, and we know that they're old, but the Bible emphasizes they were old. But that's not enough. They were advanced. Then it goes on to say they were advanced in years, right? Zikenim ba'im bayamim. They were both old and they were both advanced in years. And just in case you didn't get that, Sarah no longer had the periods of women. Okay? Orach kanashim. So there is no chance. They're old. They're very old. She long since has been postmenopausal. There's no way that they're going to have kids. Okay? And then notice, Sarah laughs out loud? No. Sarah doesn't laugh out loud, right? Sarah's much too polite to laugh out loud. She laughs to herself, saying, now that I am withered, okay, shall I have Edna? And Edna, which they translate as enjoyment, also has, interestingly, connotations of moisture, the opposite of being withered, okay? So it's both. With my husband so old, Va'adoni Zaken. So from every possible point of view, it's not just impossible, but ridiculous. That's why she laughs. Okay. Now, the laughter of Sarah is an interesting question. Is her laughter one of joy, one of absurdity, one of ridicule? I mean, it depends which commentator you look at. People interpret it differently. But it seems like the clear... Go ahead.
I think that this is interesting. If you look at the first part of it,
yeah.
The not go into the tent directly to Sarah as an issue of Yichud, but then the next part of it is, well, she's old and withered anyway. It's almost as though Yichud should no longer have applied.
To her, yeah.
It's like a foreshadowing of she still is young enough. There still is this possibility for
That's a nice idea. The idea that you normally, what Ellie said is that normally you would think that Yichud wouldn't matter if she's that old, right? It's not like you can't be alone with a 95-year-old woman. But actually, she's only 90. I'm exaggerating. That's like the Oliver Wendell Holmes story. I think I told you that one once before, where he was in his 90s. He was with another guy and a beautiful woman passed by, and he said, oh, to be 80 again. She was 90, and what she said was that you would think normally that Yichud wouldn't apply, but the fact that the angel doesn't go into a tent is a foreshadowing of the fact that that miraculously Yichud would apply to her, because in fact she will be able to bear a child. Yes?
The story is a delightful story. It's told at law school.
Is it?
The second guy was Louis Brandeis.
Louis Brandeis.
Apparently Holmes said, Louis, to be 80.
It's a nice story. I like that. So anyway, that's like, that's Robert Benchley. They asked Robert Benchley once what he was a humorist. He was actually a very funny guy. He's the father, although I'm sure he'd be horrified to have this as his major ID, but he's the father of Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws. And they asked Robert Benchley what he wanted on his gravestone. And he said, I think what I would like on my gravestone is, here lies Robert Benchley, age 105, shot by a jealous husband. Anyway, all the same vein of humor. Okay. Now, and Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now that I am withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old? Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I in truth bear a child, old as I am? Is anything too wondrous for the Lord? Now, my first question is, and I don't actually have a good answer, and I'm not sure that anybody that I read address this except in one way. Why does God even say this to Abraham? What's Abraham got to do with it? So Sarah had a moment of doubt. Why does God have to talk to Abraham and say, what's going on here? Right, he laughed earlier. That's true. But this is Sarah's laughter. Yeah.
Clearly in the Bible, God is seen as a male figure. God doesn't get women.
Right.
He's asking Abraham, she's your wife?
Right. God doesn't understand. Exactly. God is mystified by women, just like men are, in fact, in life. It's funny because the traditional answer is not so far from that. The traditional answer is that God does not, with very few exceptions, God does not speak directly to women in the Bible. So there is that feeling almost of, except that, I do want to say, in mitigation of all this male stuff, the Midrash says, and this was one of the things that I was going to bring, but I left the Midrash book upstairs. Actually, though, I do have it here. Me'am Loez, and I'll come back to it in a second. Go ahead. What were you going to say? He does speak to Hagar. I didn't say that he doesn't speak to women. He rarely speaks to women, though. And even when he speaks to Hagar, it's an angel. It's not God. This is the Lord, right? And the rabbis do parse that, how many times it says the Lord speaks. God will speak to Sarah in a minute. But here is something. This is... a nice Midrash collection that I brought. This is put out by the Sephardic collection. It's called Me'am Lo'ez, and it was like the standard collection in the Sephardic community, written by a rabbi in, I think, the 1700s. And it's in about 25 volumes. It was translated into English by Aryeh Kaplan. But anyway, Me'am Lo'ez anthologizes, brings together lots of Midrashim from lots of places, and it starts out by saying, V'yesh lishol, and we could ask, Ketzad he'iza Sarah lachish davar zeh? How did Sarah dare to question God's word on such a thing? V'hare bevadai, ein davar me'elam me'enei Adonai ha'yodei l'kol echad v'chad. And after all, God is greater than anything and can do anything. And doesn't it say that Sarah was greater in prophetic powers than Abraham? Which is what the rabbis assume. So it doubles the difficulty, because the rabbis assume that Sarah is greater in prophetic powers than Abraham. That's why Isaac has to come through her. And also, how could she deny this even if she wasn't greater? And here's the answer that they give. Yes, you want to give an answer? Yes, right.
So clearly, it's unlikely that he was the problem. Perhaps it is really the mindset of the woman and of Sarah, and even if you have prophetic powers, usually it doesn't apply to yourself.
That's very nice. The idea that Sarah, you can't, even if you're a prophet, it's very hard to be a prophet about yourself. There's a story in the Talmud about Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, at the beginning of Brachot, he goes around and he cures people. One rabbi who is sunk in darkness, which seems to be depression. And Rabbi Yochanan goes in and he lifts him up, it says. It's a very beautiful story. And then later, Rabbi Yochanan is sick. And the Talmud asks, why can't he cure himself? And their answer is, the prisoner cannot free himself from jail. So it's the same idea. The prophet can't prophesy about himself, or herself in this case. The answer that Me'am Lo'ez gives, which is based on the Midrash, is Sarah didn't know it was coming from God. They didn't know this was an angel. She thought this was a person. Had God actually spoken directly to her, she never would have laughed. But she didn't know it was God. She thought it was some, crackpot, I'm exaggerating, prognosticator, somebody who predicts the future, and had no idea that it was in fact God behind all this. That's a possibility, or it may just be that you can't believe things about yourself if they're good, even if they come from God. Yes?
In that note, wouldn't the essence of, where's her faith?
Yeah, if she understood that this was from God. But also remember, and I the tradition doesn't say this, but as readers of the Bible, we should remember, God is fairly new to these people. It's not as though, we know about Abraham and Sarah and Yitzchak and Yaakov and Rivka and Leah and the Exodus and all of that, but they don't know any of that. So, yeah. Right. Right. One nice thing about, in the Jewish, in the ketubah, you owe the woman she'er ksut va'ona. You owe her covering, clothing. What's the right term? But there's a sequence. Anyway, you owe her a roof over her head, and you owe her clothing, and you also owe her conjugal rights. Now, the idea that a man owes a woman conjugal rights speaks to the notion that sex in a marriage is not solely for a man, but also for a woman. So the same idea here. Yes. Yes. Well, I don't know if they're separable. Maybe. It could be that she's talking, because if Edna also has connotations of, it could be either one. It could be either one, yeah. Maybe she thinks, what do you mean have a child? We can't even enjoy each other anymore. It's possible, yeah.
My question is, how come God didn't confront Abraham when he left, and now he's questioning him as to why your wife left?
The question is, why did God not confront Abraham when he left, and now he's confronting Sarah when she left? He does and he doesn't. He says, nevertheless, Sarah shall bear you a son. I don't know. It depends what you think of his laugh. It says here, is it the laughter of joy, surprise, doubt, or perhaps a little of each? Whereas with Sarah, it's clearly, unambiguously that. But the question also is, who confronts Sarah, and what does it mean that God confronts her? Yes, that he says it to Abraham. He doesn't say it to Sarah.
This is sort of wrapped up with the idea of enjoyment and with the idea that a man owes his wife conjugal relationship.
Right. They had children.
Children.
Right.
So it seems to me that...
Except that that obligation doesn't stop after they have children or can't have children anymore. So that's the only thing. You owe that throughout the whole marriage. So yes, it's true that there's a big part of that is, you can't deprive your wife of the possibility of expressing her value through children, but you do owe it even after
Was
children.
There
Yes. I think they knew that even biblically, it seems like they knew that. My guess is just from observation. They saw that once people went through that, they didn't have children anymore. There's a very nice, there is a rule, a halakha, that as far as I know has never been observed. And in fact, people used to talk about this with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that if a couple is married for 10 years and has no children, they're supposed to get divorced and remarried to a different people and try to have children, okay? And as I said, the two most notable Orthodox leaders in the 20th century didn't have children and never got divorced, right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe and Joseph Soloveitchik, but neither of them. So this is not a halakha that anybody that I'm aware of actually follows, but it does lead to a very nice story in Psikta de Rav Kahana, which is a collection of Midrashim about the king who married... who got married and they didn't have children after 10 years, and he said to his wife, I love you very much, but it is obligatory that we be divorced. So I'm going to go to bed tonight, take whatever you want from the palace, anything you want is yours, because it grieves me that we have to be divorced, and go and find a new life. And of course what happens is he wakes up the next morning, she discovers that she has taken him on his bed. Had several of the servants carry it outside of the palace. Yes, it's a lovely story, and you wouldn't get that story if you didn't have such a halakha. Okay, now what is interesting about this, of course, is that Sarah laughs to herself. God speaks to Abraham, but look at the rest of it. Is anything too wondrous for the Lord? I will return to you this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. Sarah lied, saying, I did not laugh. Was anyone talking to her? Right. So in talking to Abraham again, it's as if Sarah is overhearing, okay? And is overhearing God talking, and that may answer why God speaks to Abraham. It's so that Sarah will overhear. And all it takes for God to speak directly to Sarah is for Sarah to lie. Sarah lied, saying, I did not laugh, for she was frightened, but he replied, you did laugh. Very good question. It just says Vayomer lo. Vayomer lo. It just says he said. So is it God? Is it a human being? It's not clear. It doesn't say. It could conceivably be. It's traditionally taken as God, but it's not clear that it's God. Yeah. Right. That's the other tricky thing here is she doesn't laugh out loud. So how does he know she laughed? Yeah.
So actually this whole sequence of talking, I could imagine that there's the man angel with Abraham speaking in front of the tent.
Right, the angels with Abraham speaking in front of the tent. I'm repeating this so that people can hear what you're saying. Sarah's at the, it says, she's at the entrance of the tent listening.
So after this whole sequence is happening right then, she's laughing, says, can I do this? And then the angels continuing to speak up and says, why is she laughing?
Right.
And then Sarah says, I can laugh.
Right.
But it's actually happening all in...
Yes, in one place.
Sequence.
Right.
Right at that mindset.
Yep.
I quite got that.
It's all right there at the opening of the tent.
Of course, if it's an angel God, then he knows that she's telepathic. And so
well, presumably, yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the text obviously assumes that the angel knows, or God the angel. Yeah.
A lot of times people cover their pain with laughter, and there's, you know, what we call psychology, disavowal of affect, where, you know, I see people always in my practice, as we talk about very painful events in their life, and they're smiling, and because there is this, you know, they have to adjust to their lives, and they have to adjust to smiling about their painful events, and that's how they survive. It's
right. It does make sense. I mean, even when someone hurts themselves, sometimes you laugh. All comedy is that, right? Nietzsche put it very well. He said, "Wit closes the coffin on an emotion. You feel something, you don't want to feel it. You make a joke, it's gone, right?" And so it may be. I mean, you could see if we think about Sarah's laughter here. It could be, right, to hide or to disconnect from something very painful. It could be out of nervousness, embarrassment. Here comes an angel and starts telling a 90-year-old woman, basically, that she's going to start having sex with her husband again. It could be simple embarrassment. We can think of lots of reasons. The more generous commentators say that it's joy. She's laughing, thinking, you know, could it be? Could it really be possible? Yeah. True.
And he wants to say that from now on, I'm going to miracles in heaven, but to see. So, the first time he was back, we talked about it, he laughed, she laughed, and actually, when I mean, his home, you guys laughed at
me. Right.
But I want you to know from now on, you don't need to laugh anymore because there are going to be miracles.
We've seen miracles, Noah, for example, but it's true that Abraham hasn't seen the miracles so far. His life has been fortunate, but not exactly miraculous. This is a miracle against the order of nature, and you're right, Abraham hasn't seen that yet. And maybe the laughter is the laughter of disbelief, and now that it's going to happen, he's going to see that, in fact, as you said, miracles are going to accompany him all through his journey until exactly, and also obviously for generations following. Yeah.
It seems very odd and weird how unsophisticated the way they're arguing, like little siblings.
Yeah.
You laugh, no, you did not laugh, and it's odd for me in the Torah. I don't know why you think.
Well, I would say a part of it is that. This story is, in fact, you know, every time you read a story about people, they act like people. And also God has a sort of mission to let people know that that God can do anything. And so there is this education here. I heard you laugh. I can hear inside your mind. You will have a child. I know you don't believe it. But in fact, this will happen. So that, and this is a lesson that God's going to have to repeat again and again and again and again to people before they finally believe it. I mean, and even later on, you know, the Jews in Egypt don't count on God. So there is a certain constant insistence. But yeah, it does sound young. It does sound like, yes, it's true.
It sort of closes everything.
do you understand what I'm saying? There's a validation of the pain of all the loss that she experienced by not having had a child, by having to watch Hagar.
Yeah.
But also, there's a kind of closure. I mean, you did laugh. It's a very, it elevates the entire conversation.
It clearly.
To a whole level of mutual respect.
It does end. It also ends in a very nice way, the episode, because if you can look at the Hebrew of the very end of chapter verse 15, there are 8 words. The last 8 words are Lo tzachakta ki, no, you laughed because, and then it says she was frightened, and he said Lo ki tzachakta, no, because you laughed. So those 3 words are repeated twice, but in a different order. And actually, the very end of the sentence isn't really you did laugh, not literally. It's no, because you laughed, or no, you did laugh, right? So the contradiction is pretty total. God says, no, you did laugh. And yeah, I'll come back to that in a second. Go ahead. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. Yes. Right, there is that theme, the theme of God's reading your mind, which is a very powerful theme in certain parts of the Bible, that God knows. In fact, God is called in the Talmud and elsewhere, Bochein Klayot, which literally means the checker or the person who checks or knows kidneys, because kidneys are supposed to be one of the seats of thought. But that idea is that Bochein Klayot means God who knows your mind, right? That's just an ancient idea of that. That's both a comforting and a frightening thought, depending on what your conception of God is. I mean, think about whether you like the idea that God knows what you're thinking or you don't like the idea. Well, if you have a view of God as judgmental and distant from human beings, it's frightening. If you have a view of God as gentle and loving, it's not.
I kind of see the last line about you did laugh as sort of a validation that that's okay. Look, I'm wondrous and I'm going to do this great thing, and that's okay that you laugh, but this is really big,
and that's okay. That's exactly, I mean, that's some say exactly that. You laughed. And we're going to, and in fact, so nice is your laughter that we're going to make it into his name, which is what, right, yes.
Well, I keep going back to the point. Is the sequence of seeing God in the form of the visitors, whether they're angels
right.
with Hagar, or here they're visitors and the strangers who are going to go on and play this, seems to me there's a sequence earlier, because eventually Hagar is talking the Shem Adonai, using Yod Heh Vav Heh,
right.
which is about as godlike get in our tradition. And there's a whole thing about naming, and she names God as one who sees, and I
right.
see God, and there's a whole thing about their relationship there, and this dialogue with God is such more of a Jewish relationship with God. It goes back and forth in a dialogue type of thing. They're really both...
I'm not sure I understand the contrast. Put in one sentence, Hagar is what?
Hagar goes through a process where she sees the angels, but eventually...
I understand. And what's the distinction between that and this?
What I'm saying is that it's similar.
Okay. That her relationship is similar to the one that Sarah has.
It's similar in the process.
Okay.
They actually are encounters with God.
Okay.
And yet they're in that way where it goes between the messenger
right.
and God. It's
Got
different in the human quality of how there's a laughter with God.
Different than what? It's different. This is different because it has a human quality and Hagar's doesn't?
Hagar's is more awesome.
Okay.
She's in awe of God.
And Sarah's is more intimate
yes.
with God. Yeah.
Was Hagar problem wasn't with him, it was with Sarah. And it simply is Sarah doesn't believe that she can have children.
Right.
So essentially, God is leading her along the way here. Till finally, he says, kind of, he puts the responsibility on her. Kind of, you did love. I mean, kind of, all along, I mean, she says, I'm too old, and she kind of, she doesn't believe in it. And so God finally, he says, you did love, kind of, saying, it is your responsibility. You have to change in order to make it happen.
So a lot of this has to do with what with the way in which you interpret Sarah's laughter, but I think that the general point is that the experience of God that, let's take Hagar, Abraham, and Sarah have, are all quite different, right? Hagar's experience of God is as a sort of last resort. Right. Remember, she's kicked out of the house. She has nowhere else to go. And God comes and saves her. Avram's experience of God is as a promiser who seems to be not fulfilling his promise. And Sarah's experience of God is as somebody who comes along very late in the day and tells her something that she doesn't think can really happen. But all of them, in one way or another, are going to discover that their initial experience of God is a very partial experience of God. And Sarah is going to have Yitzchak. And Avraham is, in fact, going to be blessed just the way God said he was going to be blessed. And Hagar, even though she has a tough time along the way, is going to have a child who gives birth to nations. Yeah.
Is Hagar living in Abraham's house?
Yes. Remember, she has to come back.
And is her status elevated in any
way? We don't know. We don't know. It seems like she's still Sarah's servant, as you'll see, because after Sarah has a child, Hagar's on the outs again. Yeah. She doesn't need Hagar anymore.
I really don't understand the idea of the conversation. Because God could just give them children without even telling them beforehand.
Only, yeah.
That they will become terrible.
Only if you think that God's purpose is not pedagogical. But if God's purpose is to educate, not just Abraham and Sarah, but all the readers of the Torah, then for God to work miracles without educating is useless. I mean, in that sense, and that's, the whole Torah is a lesson plan. The whole Torah actually, in that sense, is a lesson plan, because after all, I mean, what's the big deal? Let's, from one perspective, what is the big deal that God would take the Israelites out of slavery? It's so great that God can defeat Pharaoh. God created the universe, right? I mean, what's Pharaoh? Pharaoh's nothing. It's nothing. And we say, wow, he split the sea, and he's so big deal. You know, when you've actually created continents, splitting the sea is bupkis, as we say. But if you see this as an educational process for human beings, as opposed to God saying, what's the shortest distance between two points, then it makes sense. Then, in fact, and that's why everything that's said is supposed to contain infinite numbers, right, of interpretations. In fact, I didn't, if those of you who will be in synagogue this Shabbat, and I know that's all of you, but and by the way, you should come to hear Reuven Kimmelman either tonight or tomorrow. I think there's a tea dinner tonight, but tomorrow there's a luncheon, which some people will come to hear. Anyway, but if you're there tomorrow, the study source tomorrow is a source taken from the Midrash, which says that it compares a king who had two children, and basically they got wheat, and one of them made it into bread and one didn't. And it compares that to the Torah. That is, God gave us the Torah, but the Torah is wheat. And what turns it into bread is interpretation. And it's not just to read the story. It is to do exactly what we're doing, which is to open new perspectives on it. And also this opens a certain perspective on Abraham and Sarah's marriage. Because Abraham, and this I think is interesting actually, and this goes to the difference between men and women, is you'll notice where you said, why didn't Abraham get upset when he laughed? And what happened was, God comes to Abraham and says, verse 17, of chapter 17. Abraham threw himself on his face and laughed as he said to himself, can a child be born to a man 100 years old, or can Sarah bear a child at 90? Okay, that's his reaction. What's Sarah's reaction? Now that I'm withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old? What's the difference? What's that?
Doubting,
yes, but so is Abraham. He says, can a child be born to a man 100 years old? Because he's 100 years old. Yeah.
One's physical and one's emotional.
Right, I think so too. I think that it's like, here's the difference. Right, here's the difference. Let me tell you what Miguel de Unamuno said about Aristotle's syllogism. The syllogism that you learn in logic is, Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's the classic Greek syllogism. Unamuno, who was an existentialist philosopher, said the proper way to render that syllogism is, I am a man, all men are mortal, therefore I will die. In other words, he said, abstract logic isn't really what human beings are about. And what that syllogism really teaches you is that you will die. And when you confront that, that's the beginning of philosophy, not this abstract logic. Now look at the difference. Abraham says, can a child be born to a man 100 years old? Completely impersonal. Doesn't say to me, right? But he throws Sarah in, or can Sarah bear a child at 90? But look how Sarah's begins. Now that I am withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old? It even speaks of his relationship to her. Abraham just says, Sarah. Doesn't say with my wife so old. Hers is much more intimate, concrete, you know, feminine as opposed to masculine. Yeah.
I've always had a problem with the ages in biblical characters. one theory that has come up in the years that I've studied Torah is that the years are counted as seasons.
I don't buy it.
You don't buy that?
No. I'll tell you why. Here's the problem is that people play both sides of the fence. They say, well, the 7 days are really 7 billion years, right, for the creation of the universe. But then when they get to the ages of characters, they say, actually, every year is only a season. So they stretch days into endless times, when I think that the answer is that, in especially for mythological characters, when they talk about Methuselah living 969 years, it's because mythological characters get exaggerated ages, and I don't think in the ancient world people were as careful. I mean, we don't have mentions of birthdays. I don't think 100 years probably means very old. Modern scholars don't think 40 means 40. 40 means a long span of time. Because Moses is up there for 40 days, they wander for 40 years. It's too coincidental that everything is 40. In fact, I think these are representative ages. I don't think, even though we'll treat them as specific, I don't think they're really specific ages. Right.
It says in the area of the world that they live, there were 2 seasons a year in our
right.
years today. So if
so you get 45 and 50.
It's not unlikely that they could have a child.
Right.
Yes, that's
and
true.
It's not unlikely that she would have possibly not had.
What about, but what do you do with the other, what do you do with Methuselah? Divide his life in half and you still got 400 some years, you know? I mean, it's possible once you, right, once the post-mythological part, once Abraham comes in, maybe that works. I haven't tried to divide everyone's life. I can just imagine saying to Abraham, look, I know you're 50, but you look 100.
If you go further to the story of the Akedah, where...
right, well, there's a problem.
Isaac is supposedly
38, right, but he's...
But if he was 18...
Even 18, yeah, even 18, although he feels to me like 12
yes.
in that story, not 18.
Yes.
But especially because 18 is a lot older in the ancient world than it is now. I mean, people got married at 13.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a very interesting question. It's not susceptible of an answer, but it certainly is possible that many of the terms, it's misleading. When the Bible uses terms that we know on our own terms, we can't always assume that they're the same. So it's true, when it says 100, it may not mean 100 the way we think of it, but we don't have access to that. We do know, though, that one of the ways that you declare the importance of any character in all sorts of ancient stories is by making them live a long time. So who knows? You know, Sarah lives, what is it, 45 years less than Abraham? I think something like that, and some commentators say this is why. They're always trying to find out why some people live longer, some people live shorter, and they give this as the reason, because she doubts God. Others not, but some yes. So, yeah.
She also lost a son, you know, and I'm sure that that had...
Well, she didn't lose a son.
But yes, because he left.
In that sense. Right.
I mean, he didn't die, but
no.
he left the house.
Yeah. Right, and that's one of the theories behind the Akedah that we will come to in a couple of chapters. Yeah.
I don't know if this is significant, but the difference between what was said when Abraham left and when Sarah left, Abraham questions actually bearing the child,
right.
Having the child. She's talking about the act of conceiving it.
Maybe that's the difference. It might be that Abraham doesn't say we can't conceive. Sarah does. I don't know. It would make a very interesting study to look at the comment of the two of them and the reaction.
He even says that. He says, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old? And so he is even more clear and more upfront about his doubts.
Now, all of this, as I said, this is a kind of transitional class. All of this is a prelude, because every story in Genesis, and especially, maybe even the story of Joseph and of Abraham, takes place on a public platform and a private platform. There's a family story, but there's also a heroic public story. And Abraham is about to take his stand as a public figure. Now, he did this in part with the war with the kings, if you remember, in chapter 15, where he goes to war to save Lot and to save the kings who are attacked. But with the story of Sodom, which is about to come up, there are lots and lots of questions, not the least of which is what were the people of Sodom doing wrong, which we'll talk about next week. There are several interesting theories to try to figure out what was going on in Sodom that made it such a terrible place. But also, the story of Sodom is going to be a necessary background to the Akedah later, because later on, God says something to Abraham, and Abraham doesn't question him at all, right? He says, take your son, and doesn't question him. And if you didn't know the story of Sodom, you might think that Abraham was afraid to question God. But knowing the story of Sodom, you have to find a different explanation for Abraham's silence, because he's clearly not afraid of God, since, although actually after watching Sodom be destroyed, who knows? However, he goes to Sodom now with the promise in hand, although not realized. And we have... to a great extent, we as the readers now expect that the promise to be solidified. I mean, as a reader, you now believe that Isaac is going to be born, because we've seen God create the world, after all. Okay, any other comments, questions? Going once. Next time, you can look at, if you want to read it before, it's a fairly long story. It will probably take us at least, I would guess, two sessions. But it is a fascinating story and has a great deal in it. And so we will talk next time about Sodom, and have a good Shabbos.